Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Joining me on Midnight in Karachi today is Rebecca Levine, who has written many, many things, novels, games, television shows, and has edited many, many things too, including a series of Doctor Who novels. Her latest books are Smiler's Fair and The Hunter's Kind, which are two of the Hollow Gods quartet of epic fantasy novels. She also works on the Zombies Run app. Bex, welcome back.
Hi there. Thank you for having me back.
Am I using the right word, quartet?
Yes, I think so. That's what I'm calling it.
And is it still a quartet?
Yes, I haven't done a George R. R. Martin. There are still going to be four of them. I'm working on book three at the moment. And from the start, I knew the basic shape of the story as it broke across those four books, and that is still in place.
It's funny you bring up George R. R. Martin, because that was my first question. I remember reading somewhere that Game of Thrones was what brought you back into epic fantasy, a genre you'd kind of drifted away from for a while. What was it about his work that made you excited enough to sort of write epic fantasy?
I think I'd forgotten how good epic fantasy could be. I drifted away from it in my sort of late 20s, I think. Probably because I read one too many bad books in a row, and we all know any genre has some very bad stuff in it. And it was around the time, I'm trying to think what was coming out in fantasy at the time I stopped reading it. I think it had reached a bit of a rut. It was people writing the sort of seventh books of their various series and writing very much in the tradition of Tolkien or Eddings, which I think is another kind of strand within it. And then I don't know why I picked Game of Thrones up, because someone must have told me something about it. I must have read something about it. I saw the book in the shop. I think it was for a holiday. I picked it up and I just thought, wow, this is what the genre can do now. I thought the characterization was astonishingly good. The breadth of the story, the unpredictability of the story, that was a really big thing, because there's a certain pleasure to be had in knowing where something is going, but really that can get a bit tiresome in fantasy in your typical quest novel, where you were pretty certain they were going to find the object they were looking for and then probably use it to defeat the evil they were fighting against. And Game of Thrones had none of that. I liked how much it brought the historical stuff in. I mean, obviously, I think George R. R. Martin said himself he wanted to kind of write a historical novel where he didn't know the ending, so he had set in a fantasy universe, but it has the feeling of historical fiction. And I just thought that's the kind of stuff I could write. Not to say I could write as well as him, or certainly not as successfully, but it felt like the genre had moved to a place where I was the right kind of writer to write for it, if that makes sense.
Right. Now, your original idea for this series was, I believe, and from when we last spoke about Smiler's Fair, it was of a place that had to keep moving. This titular fair itself was a city that couldn't really survive if it didn't move because of, you know, the monsters, essentially, in the earth that were left behind. But what about the cast of these books? Where did they come from, and how did you sort them into all their houses, as it were?
Well, actually, I mentioned Eddings before, and when I first came up with the idea of the book in conversation with friends, I knew I'd need a large cast for it because it was going to be that kind of book. And the trouble at the start of any sort of creative endeavour is you have too many options and you have to do something to narrow them down. And I wanted to address the archetypes within a certain strand of fantasy, the Eddings strand of fantasy. And so I thought I should go back to his books and look at his characters, because they are very archetypal. In a way, I think more than Tolkien's characters are now. People still use lots of stuff from Tolkien. Of course, there are elves, there are dwarves, there are big quests, there are, you know, evil objects. But Eddings had things like, you know, the warrior without a tribe, the sort of the cheerful assassin. And I felt like those had actually been picked up and run with by a lot of people. And I wanted to take those archetypes and then think about who I thought real people would be, who represent real people to me within my world, and do a twist on them. Because much as I enjoyed Eddings when I read him, and I still think he's hugely enjoyable, but he does have some quite unfortunate stuff in there. There's sort of a racial essentialism. There's a lot of sexism. And so I wanted to take the characters that were written with those problems and then see what I could do with them. So, for example, and the characters I came up with, especially once I started writing them in the story and seeing where they wanted to go within my plot, they became their own people completely. But for example, there's a character, I've forgotten her name, in the Belgariad. I don't know if you've read it yourself.
I have not. Yeah. In fact, yours was, I think you were the first person who'd mentioned to me. I didn't know about it.
It was very big when I was a teenager, I guess. So I think, I suspect a lot of people of my generation have read it. There's a character in it who is, she's the last of her people, and she's been used as a sex slave, and her role within the book is to recreate her people. And I was thinking about how much that's often the female role in those kinds of books. You know, she's seen as, her importance is as a sexual object and as a mother, and who her child is more important than who she is. And she became Eric because I wanted to see what happened if you made that character a man. And that happened with, you know, a lot of them, different sorts of ways. The warrior, all of his tribe have been killed. Obviously, that's Dehio in my book. And in my book, he's a raging alcoholic because I don't think you generally survive very well the loss of your entire people. So that's where they all came from. At least some of them. Then some of them just sprung fully formed onto the page. Sometimes a character just walks into a scene and you find yourself having to put them in the book. And I know that sounds, it's one of those things where I just say anything, yeah, whatever, you don't really mean it. But it kind of does happen. It is almost like they've got a mind of their own.
Was Eric the first character that came to your mind?
No, Krish was the first character because, without giving too much away, he's sort of, to some extent, his story is the engine of the whole, of the overarching narrative of the series. He was my first person. I think Eric was one of the early ones, yeah.
I keep meaning to ask you, have you seen the Hindi movie, Krish?
No, I haven't.
You must. It's a Hindi superhero movie, essentially.
Wow, okay.
I suppose. I'm using the word superhero liberally, that genre liberally. But I mean, every time, because it's ridiculous the kind of baggage a reader brings into their own, you know, reading of a book. Every time I read the word Krish on the page in either of your books, I see in my head the Indian actor Hrithik Roshan who played that character.
Right.
Which is ridiculous. Oh, really? I mean, it's so random, but that's how my brain kind of, you know what I mean? So yes, I have cast Krish in your book in my head.
I think it's always helpful to cast people. It was funny with his name because in most of my first draft, I think till about draft six, his name was spelt with a CH. And then my editor said they didn't know how to pronounce it, so I changed it to a K. And then I realised that the way it had been written before, it kind of had echoes of Christ in the way it looked. And then the way it's written now, it kind of has echoes of Krishna, neither of which was intentional at all. But I do wonder if there was something ticking over in the back of my mind that led me to choose that particular name for him. I mean, because he is, well, I can't say without spoilers, but yeah.
Well, we can say he's, you know, special.
Yes, he's special, exactly.
Now, the idea of suffering as ennobling was something that you'd looked at in Smiler's Fair too. I remember that. Is it ennobling?
I think it can be in very rare instances that should be celebrated, but I think generally it's corrosive. I certainly know just for myself that when things are going badly, for me, I'm less generous towards other people. I mean, in practical ways and also in emotional ways, I have less left to give to anybody else. And also, I can become very bitter and angry, and I think... And, you know, this kind of suffering I've been through is first world problems, is very small scale. And so when people go through really, really dreadful things, I think, yeah, it can destroy them. And I don't think we can judge people for that. But if we hold up this standard where suffering is supposed to make people better, then we look at particularly areas of conflict around the world where people have had bad things happen to them and then they in turn do bad things. And instead of saying, having some empathy for it and trying to understand it and trying to understand that the way to stop this is to stop the bad things in the first place, we instead say, they should know better. They've suffered themselves. How can they hurt other people? Which just seems to me utterly unrealistic and utterly unhelpful. And that's one of the things I want to look at in the book.
But plenty of your characters do suffer.
Yeah, they pretty much all do, I think.
Yeah. Come on, my author. Similarities between you and George R. R. Martin.
Yeah. I don't think my stuff is as grim as his.
Probably not. But I feel the suffering is there. And we're not going to talk about how many people can be. I don't know. Do you enjoy killing off characters? Would you? We're not going to go into details, of course. But
I certainly will if the plot requires it. I don't enjoy it. There's a character. He's a fairly minor character in book two. Who wasn't in the synopsis, he was one of those ones who just sort of sprang onto the page. And I loved him. And at the same time, the instant he appeared, I knew I was going to have to kill him. And I did try and think of ways of not killing him, because I liked him enough to want to keep him around. But in the end, you have to be true to the story. I suppose what to counterbalance that kind of stuff, what you need is some light as well, some fun, but also some warm relationships and friendships in particular, which I think is one of the things I look at quite a lot in the books. Because even when things are going terribly, and even when things are being people are being embittered and warped by what's happening to them, they still have positive bonds with other people generally, as well as all the negative things that are happening.
Absolutely. Well, that's what makes for a well-rounded, you know, novel in any case, in any genre, really.
Hopefully.
Now, world building can be incredible, can be exhausting, can be both of these things for both the reader and the writer. But what's that aspect of writing the Hollow Gods books for you? How has that worked out? I know you had a massive world Bible, didn't you?
Yes, which I'm still adding to it. So I think it's getting on for 40,000 words long now. I think I did it a slightly reverse order from the way a lot of fantasy writers do. I know a lot of people write their world Bible first. And sometimes the books are written out of a desire to explore that world that they've created, or that sometimes they can read that way anyway. I knew my characters, I knew my story, I knew the basics of the world, like the fact that there's something living below the ground that means you can't stay still, everyone has to keep moving. And, you know, I knew this culture was tribal, I knew this culture was a kingdom, but I didn't know a huge amount more than that when I wrote my first draft. And it was only when I had a first draft of the first book that I could look at what I'd created and think about what kind of world I needed then to serve the story that these characters were in. And then I wrote my world Bible, and then I went back and did a big pass on everything, putting the details of the world in, which seems like an odd way around to do it. And obviously I didn't do that with subsequent books in the series, but it seemed to work for me, I guess, because it meant my world served my story rather than the story served the world, if that makes sense.
Right. I love the idea that there were things that you had to add to later as well, because, you know, obviously in a world so unlike, say, ours, there's certain things don't mean the same thing to these characters as they would to us. For example, and you'd written about this in a blog somewhere I was reading about, for example, if someone was, you know, if you damn someone, is it a curse? Does it make sense to them? You call someone a certain sort of, you know, slur. Is it a slur in that culture or not? And I imagine you were probably pushed into moving away from what most real world, you know, cultural influences may have been.
Yeah, I did think very carefully about the language that was used, and because I tend to write close third person, my narrative tends to be to some extent in the voice of the characters as well, which meant that I was really limited in the language I could use in narrative as well as dialogue to stuff that these people would actually think. And it's fascinating once you get down to it, you know, how much of our language, it's not surprising, is very culturally specific. And you have to decide where you draw the line at not using words that are specific to our culture. I mean, clearly you're not going to say he'd been programmed to behave this way, because that would be ridiculous in the kind of culture I was creating. But I had found myself at one stage wanting to have someone say there's no use crying over spilt milk. And I spent probably too much time thinking about that, thinking, well, I mean, yes, they probably do spill milk and maybe get upset about it, but is it too reminiscent of our culture? In the end, I had the character saying, there's no use lamenting the arrow that's missed, which sometimes I'm wary of that sort of translating phrases from our culture into another, but I felt that worked. It was getting the same sentiment across in ways that that worked within that particular setting. But only my readers can tell me whether I succeeded or not.
Well, there's lots and lots of cultural sort of influences, I suppose, that have played into how you created the societies of the Hollow Gods books. And will you tell me a little bit about how you brought the various elements together to create this world?
Well, I did my degree in social anthropology, which I think really helped. So, for example, there's a group of tribes, the 14 tribes, who are nomadic pastoralists, basically. Now, when I was creating their culture, I did some reading around to remind myself of how various nomadic pastoral cultures around the world function. What I didn't want to do was take cultural specifics from that. I just wanted to take the general sense of the cultures will often have a spring festival, you know, what kind of things have value for them. But I'm very aware of the debate that's going on in the genre at the moment around cultural appropriation. And I didn't I didn't want to appropriate other people's cultures. Also because I wanted my cultures to be specific to my world, not just sort of analogues of real world cultures. So I took the sort of the principles, I guess, behind the things that real world cultures do, and then thought about how they would apply in my world. And also with that added constraint that people had to keep moving because there's something living beneath the ground. And to some extent, my world is a sort of post-fantasy apocalypse. The big war between the gods has happened. It happened 1,000 years ago, and these new people have come in and are living in the ruins of the land left behind after that battle. So that gave it a very sort of specific feeling as well.
You've written many genres and for different forms of media over the years, and so far, what did you enjoy the most? And I have to ask, what was the easiest and what was the hardest to write?
I'm not sure enjoy is ever the right word to use about writing. I think most
and yet you do it.
Well, but not just me. I think most writers I've ever spoken to hate the process of writing. They just like having written something. I think I'm getting the most satisfaction out of these books, to be quite honest. They're the most me. I did write a zombie novel set in the Roman Empire. It was basically I, Claudius, with zombies. And I love classical history, and I really enjoyed doing that. Probably the hardest thing I've ever done was novelising a video game, just because novelising anything is pretty tough, because you're constrained in what you can do, and also you have to make somebody else's story make sense. And if your story didn't come out of your head, you may well be reading it going, but why are they doing that? And if I'd been writing it, they would have done this instead, but you can't let that happen. You have to write what you're given. But the thing I find hardest is actually non-fiction. I don't think I'm very good at it. And I find it much, much more of a chore than writing fiction, because you have to do actual research. What's that all about?
Well, that's ridiculous. You did a lot of research, for example, for these books. There's no denying it.
I did, but I didn't have to, you know. But then I could just make right. stuff up at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to stick to the search, and I didn't have to, you know, double source it and confirm it. And yeah, I just... And also, actually, I'll tell you the very hardest thing I've ever written. I wrote a notoriously not very well-reviewed video game called... I wrote the script for Rogue Warrior. It was about Dick Marcinko, who was the founder of SEAL Team 6, Special Ops American, you know.
Right, right.
And it was a shooter. It was him and his gang ran around shooting people. And I play games a lot. But one of the things I hadn't been aware that is a writer's job to do for games is to write what are called the AI barks, which are the things that various characters not controlled by the player will say in particular situations. And because they'll be heard a lot, you have to come up with variants for them, because the player's going to get very sick of them. And for some reason, I will never understand this, the games industry generally thinks that game scripts should be written in Excel, the least creative program. Yeah, I don't know why.
I didn't know that.
Excel document having to write 9 variants on there's enemies to our left high up, which was like enemies 6 o'clock high, bogey 6 o'clock high, and doing this for every single different thing. Enemies 6 o'clock low was pretty soul destroying, I have to say.
Since then, have you written another video game?
Not a console title, but I've been working on Zombies Run, which is right. a game as well, but it's an app game rather than a console game.
How's that going?
It's great. I love it. It's so much fun. I work very closely with Naomi. He's one of the co-creators, Naomi Alderman. And it's anything creative is tough. And when we're sort of breaking the story together for a season, we spend a lot of time striding up and down, getting angry with ourselves for failing to have the ideas we're supposed to be having, or getting snappy with each other because we're getting angry about not having the ideas. But it's immensely satisfying. And it's such a great game. And I can say that because it's not my game. I'm proud to be associated with it. So, yeah.
Now, The Hunter's Guide, which is the second book of the Hollow Gods Quartet, was out a few weeks ago. People who have not read it, what should they be looking forward to in this?
Well, if they've read the first one, which they should do before they read it, otherwise it won't make a huge amount of sense, it is taking the characters and, I guess, broaden the story. I think it's a bit more action-packed than the first one. The first one asks my characters who they are, and they spend most of the book defining themselves one way or another. But this book asks the characters how far will you go to get what you want? The answer, obviously, because it's one of my books, is quite far indeed. And so we get to see new bits of the world, we get to meet a lot of new characters, and hopefully get to see them do exciting things. As it's hard to talk about it without giving too much away about the first book, but
stuff happens.
Yeah. So as the repercussions of the first book sort of echo out throughout the rest of this world, basically.
Yeah. I find there's lots of stuff about pregnancy and birth in The Hunter's Kind. And of course, I kept thinking back to Smiler's Fair, which, and this is not really a spoiler, also in the beginning, right in the beginning, there was a birth scene. And it kind of all ties in together. Is there a reason why so much of that comes into this?
I think I definitely want to look at parenthood, because sort of the model for fantasy is often, you know, the orphan whose parents are gone. And I can see why people do that, but the parental relationship is such an important one, and what makes a good or bad parent is such a fascinating and important question that I really wanted to look at it and to have unexpected people as parents, and to have parents behave in unexpected ways, and to get at the sort of complexities of relationships between parents and children, because I think they're some of the sort of most tortured and messy and strong relationships we have in our lives. And so why wouldn't you want to write about them?
Absolutely. Now let's talk about Once Upon a Time, Bex. How are you still watching the show?
Look, don't get me wrong, it is a terrible...
I know this, you know this. I mean, I just want to know how you sort of... I admire your, I don't know, patience, determination, whatever it is, because, you know, as you know, I let go a couple of seasons. I don't even know how long ago, but I'm just amazed. How are you doing this? Tell me how you're keeping up with it, and what have you sort of, what are you taking from it right now?
I'll tell you what I love about it. It's really bad on several fronts. It's really, really bad on racial representation. It's so white. It's shameful. It's really appallingly heteronormative.
Right.
But it's really feminist. It's one of the few shows that would regularly fail the reverse Bechdel test, if there was such a thing. You very rarely get men talking to each other. The men never drive the action. The men are basically ornaments and rewards for the women, and that's really kind of refreshing.
Right.
Also, it's demented.
Yeah.
It's so daft, and there's not anything like that anymore. People don't make shows that are that insane, where, you know, Tinkerbell is having a crisis of confidence and goes to talk to, I don't know, Captain Hook about it. I mean, isn't that kind of wonderful that you can watch that on television?
It kind of is, that I was watching it on television. And I'm not anymore. But we had Lost Girl and you gave up on that. So I had to do that on my own.
Yeah, I know. I am going to go back to Lost Girl. I think they're pretty comparable, really, in terms of their...
Well, Lost Girl has a far smaller budget. Far smaller.
Yes. That's well, you say that, but the special effects in Once Upon a Time are pretty awful.
That's true. They just have a bigger cast, and I think they have more money to spend on people than, say, Lost Girl does.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm glad you're still watching it, because it's still, as I keep saying, yours and Anne's summaries and tweets about it are enough for me right now. Have you seen... Sorry, go ahead.
I'm mainly watching it for Regina, the Evil Queen. I mean, that's what it's all about.
She is amazing.
If she wasn't in, I wouldn't watch it.
Well, let's hope they keep her. I think they know that she's it. She's what, you know, brings a lot of people to the, you know, yard, as it were. Now, have you seen the trailers for the Disney Channel's The Descendants? I saw this earlier today and I thought of you right away. It's about all the Disney villains' kids crossing the divide to come live with the kids of the heroes. You've seen this?
It's really funny you say that, because Jared actually emailed me and Anne that trailer yesterday.
I just saw this today. It's insane, right?
It's amazing.
Has everyone forgotten how to do lip syncing? Is what I was wondering.
Because it's a musical as well, isn't it? It's a musical about the children.
I cannot wait. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm going to say this publicly. I can't wait, really.
Oh, there's nothing in the world will stop me from watching that, probably repeatedly.
All right, what's all this about a poker book that you've written? I just found out today.
Yes, I wrote a beginner's guide to poker. I should stress that I've read quite a lot about poker. I was very into it for a while, and I read a lot of books like Herbert Yardley's The Education of a Poker Player and Amarillo Slim's autobiography. So I did know a lot about poker, and I know how to play it well, but I absolutely can't play it well because I don't have the nerve, particularly for no-limit poker, and I've got no poker face at all. So anyone sitting at a table with me is going, oh, she's got a good hand. She's got a terrible hand. So, if I ask you to play poker with me, don't be afraid that I'm some kind of card shark that's gonna clean you out, because I'm gonna be walking away from the table with no money at the end of it.
So you're basically good at poker in theory.
In theory, I'm great at it, yeah. In practice, yeah, I'm just terrible.
All right, so I know what you've been watching on TV. I know what you're going to be watching on TV as soon as this Descendants business is out. But what are you reading? What have you read recently? Is something amazing that you want to tell us about? Something terrible that we should stay away from?
I've actually I bought it a while ago, and I don't know why I didn't read it, but I'm reading finally reading Jonathan Coe's latest book. It's not a fantasy book, but the terrible privacy of Maxwell. I've forgotten his surname. Maxwell Slim? Anyway, it's that one. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. I loved everything else of his I've read. He's a social satirist, British. He's tremendously funny and tremendously cutting, but also very empathetic. The central character of the Maxwell book is a man who's led a very mundane life, who has a lot of very mundane thoughts, who speaks in quite a mundane way, and it's a first person narrative. And that's quite a challenge to make a book interesting that's narrated by a man who's essentially quite dull, and yet it's really gripping. You really care about him. It has absolute empathy for who he is and how he's become who he is and the problems he's having. And it's also just, it's hilarious. He uses language beautifully. He has one character in the scene that I've just read who speaks entirely in mixed metaphors, which he clearly doesn't understand.
Right.
So he says at one point, it's no use just playing on the band in the Titanic. Someone has to be shuffling the deck chairs.
Right.
No, it doesn't. It's great. I would recommend everyone read it. And it made me, as I was reading it, made me realize that that is my favorite genre of lit fic, I think, is very dark comedy, or stuff with some dark humor within it anyway. Catch 22, for example, is a book that I regularly reread.
All right, well, I hope we'll speak again when the next book is out. I'm
That
looking
would be
forward to it.
fantastic.
No pressure, I'm just looking forward to it. When is the next book out?
It doesn't have a set publication date, but it will be at some point next year.
Some point next year. All right. Well, thank you, Bex.
My pleasure.